deputy sheriffs and arresting agencies, since in fact they never send them. I mean, the courts sometimes do, but as I understand it, it is very uncommon for DAs or sheriffs or the arresting agencies to send the reports. So the couple changes in here is that rather than the way it was phrased now was that the parole board shall obtain from each of those parties, now it would be restricted to the sentencing court and phrased in terms of the sentencing court shall provide to the board. It also specifies in certain kinds of cases that a transcript of statement of reasons be furnished to the board. In other cases, the board could request them. And those are cases like dangerous offender cases, minimum mandatories, and so forth. Section 17 is also from Senate Bill 86 and related to the case that arose when, because the statute required the parole board to consider reports and so forth from DAs and sheriffs and law enforcement, the parole board didn't receive them. Section 17 would provide that the board will consider reports from judges and PSI or its equivalent. Sections 18 and 19 are just additional changes to conform to the changes in terminology of parole. Section 20 is taken from House Bill 2218, which was to limit the time that a person could be held without a warrant from the court on a probation violation. Sections 21 to 23 also were from 2218. They contain the 15-day limit for a hearing by the Division on Probation Violator holds without a court warrant. Sections 24 and 25 would put a similar 15-day limit on the time within which the board would have to consider a hearing, to conduct a hearing when a person was pulled in for parole violation. Section 26 on page 22 was incorporated it came from House Bill 2760, and that had to do with the provision of information concerning a convicted person's history by a parole or probation officer. The committee had asked that we refer to the Corrections Division rule governing the release of client-related information by parole and probation officers to employers or prospective employers, and it directs that the officer consider the safety aspects of employment to the employer and to others. And subsection 2 of that section exempts the parole probation officer from liability for the exercise of their discretion in that instance, except for the case in other than a case of defamation. Section 27 came from House Bill 2084, which was an interim task force bill that provided that community corrections plans should include community service programs as practicable, and that the court should be advised of the options available to them. Sections 28 to 30 were to incorporate Bill Gary's proposals that stem from House Bill 2265 with modifications. There was one other bill that had been requested to be included, but at this point was not because of some discussions that followed, and that was House Bill 2896. What the committee had asked for was that it would have allowed a period of confinement to be followed by a consecutive sentence of probation, but was going to limit the stay of incarceration that could be followed by a probation sentence. And in the discussions that followed, and the reason that we'd left it out was that if you get down to the shorter sentences, you can already give a probation. Do you want to wait on that?
No, I was just recalling that discussion we'd had with Judge Bumbrick. Okay. Go ahead.
But you can give a sentence of, let's say, if the person's going to be out in 2 years and you gave them a probation sentence of 5, by the time they get out, you could still have running concurrently 3 more years of probation supervision over them. And it was seeming like if we were going to keep to the shorter sentences, you could still, even with the concurrent sentence of probation, have a significant supervision period time over them at the time they got out of prison. That's why, at this juncture, it's not included in there.
Questions on that at this point? Okay, we're going to take about a 4 or 5 minute recess, then we'll start our testimony. I'd like to start with Judge Hargraves and perhaps Judge Bonebrake, if you'd both like to come up when we return. We'll start with your perspectives. So recess about 5 minutes. Okay, Judge Hargraves, Judge Bonebrake.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Bonebrake. I'm a circuit court judge, and I am on the Oregon Judicial Conference Legislative Committee. This is Judge Hargraves from Lane County. Judge Hargraves' name has become a household word in this committee over the last few months.
It has.
And he's here today to clear up any doubt about what he stands for and what he does not. My initial comment in looking at 2087, and I know the effort in redrafting does incorporate what's been referred to previously basically as the Hargreaves proposal. I see that appearing at the bottom of page 1 and the top of page 2, and what follows in the remaining 24 pages I think would even shock Judge Hargreaves. I understand, though, that what was attempted here was to include in this bill, as an omnibus bill, many concepts that were included in a lot of other bills, and I know that you do intend to review all those individually. Some of them may stand or may fall on their own merit, and it does make sense to discuss these together since they are, many of them, interrelated. First of all, I'm in a difficult position because I have talked to a lot of judges around the state, and I think I have an idea about generally the philosophies of circuit court judges in sentencing. We haven't made any official poll, and so some of what I'm saying is going to be my own opinion. It's almost impossible for me to segregate out what I believe as to what I, from what I know from discussions with other judges, but if what I'm going to say is just an out-and-out personal opinion, I'll try to label it as that so you'll know. First of all, on page 2, and we're talking now about section 3, lines 11 through 14.
What page now, Judge?
Page 2 of the bill, the new bill. Counsel Linda Zuckerman has pointed out to you that that language is a bit loose, and I think that you've made that same observation. I've written quite mild in the margin, although I think that what's printed there would find favor with most of the circuit judges, because I know that a lot of them oppose a requirement of making findings in every case. In other words, I think the judges would like that. That's not my idea of what was intended when we initially discussed this. Frankly, I think judges would like to have the authority to make those findings in cases where they think it's appropriate and not make findings in others. As it's drafted there, as you know, judges could simply say, I don't desire to assist the parole board or the state board of prison terms, and thus make no findings at all. And I think you'd find that would occur in a number of cases. So if what you intend is to require findings, then you ought to say it.
My own sense right now is, as a first step, to make it optional rather than mandatory, but to tighten the language as to the findings that we're referring to and relate them more specifically to those factual elements that bear on the application of the matrix ranges. But that's just a comment of my own. I thought the language was both loose and maybe the rest of that language is adequate for that purpose. In any event, you'll certainly be weighing the mandatory aspect very carefully.
I think the problem that we may have with that is that those findings that are applicable to the matrix are subject to change by the parole board or the board of prison terms and supervised release, and And so we'll be subjected from time to time to changes as they may adopt changes in the factors that they consider in deciding an appropriate sentence. But at any rate, I simply point out to you that what you already know, and that is that language is quite loose, and we could discuss that more, I'm sure, if you believe that the law ought to be changed in that regard to require findings in some cases or and not in others or in all cases, change that language to reflect your intent more appropriately. My next comment has to do with, it's on page 5. If you'll turn to page 5, section 6, beginning on line 17. And it's really only an observation. And my hope is that this observation is based on what I perceive to be correct. As you know, House Bill 2087, as originally drafted, required the Board on Prison Terms, which was going to be the board to devise the matrix range, to consider the capacities of state and local correctional facilities in devising the sentencing matrix and the range. And I note the absence of any such language here now. And although capacities of institutions is something that has to be considered, my feeling is, and this is my own personal opinion, that corrections policy ought not be dictated, in other words, the appropriate sentence for an individual given a crime and a history ought not be overridden by the capacity in the institutions. It's something that obviously has to be considered, but at the beginning, when we're determining what an appropriate sentence is for this individual for committing this crime, given his history and his record, I hope that we're not to the point where we have to look at the prison capacities and say, well, you deserve a sentence of X months, but because we don't have any room, instead you're going to receive a sentence of something less than that.
Which specific language were you referring to, or which section?
In the original, okay, I'm referring now to section 6 on page 5.
Okay.
And if you'll note, it says the commission shall propose to the board, and the board shall adopt rules establishing ranges of duration of imprisonment, etc., and then sets forth those things that are to be considered. The absence of the language about dealing with prison capacities, I think, is noteworthy, and I hope that was intended. In other words, that's not something that at the front end that we ought to be concerned with in determining what an appropriate sentence should be. Obviously, there needs to be some mechanism for release because of overcrowding, but I hope we're not to the point where we say that's something that we need to consider initially in imposing sentences on individuals. The process, the mental process that I go through in sentencing when I do consider that is to determine what an appropriate sentence is, and then I may make a judgment that's unrealistic because we don't have the space in the prison institutions, we don't have the space in the county jail, but initially I try to determine what an appropriate sentence is. And to build into the statute that particular criteria, I just think philosophically I disagree with.
Well, do you think, let me make sure I understand, do you think that, are you saying that you do not think the ranges themselves, the matrix, should be affected by capacity?
Yes, I do say that. I think there needs to be some mechanism for release, but I think it ought to be outside the determination of what an appropriate prison sentence ought to be initially. I think we ought to be realistic. There ought to be appropriate prison sentences for persons with particular criminal records for offenses that they commit. But then, given the fact that we don't have space for them, there should be some mechanism to take care of that through release of particular types of offenders.
Okay, the thrust of my question was really to make sure I understood whether or not you were talking just about how that factor might be imposed as a criterion for a judge to consider in terms of whatever power a judge has to determine the actual period of confinement, as opposed to the formulation of the matrix by the board, or the adoption of the matrix by the board. I take it, though, you were saying that in both cases, let's say in the case of a judge specifying a minimum period of confinement, or in the case of the ranges themselves, the capacity of the institutions in the system should not be a factor.
Well, that's true. I could clarify that more if I was required to, but I do philosophically. And apparently, it just comes from having sentenced individuals, and I have given a great deal of thought to this. It seems to me that, and we go through this process every time we sentence a defendant. We know what his history is. We know the offense that he's been convicted of. We know the particulars about the victim, the impact on the victim or society in general. We know, as I said, his prior record, and we try to determine what an appropriate sentence is. Is rehabilitation possible? Is it necessary simply to incarcerate him to lessen the risk to all the rest of us? And frankly, initially in that initial determination, and I assume that in devising a range, a matrix, the parole board goes through that same sort of process. They take particular types of offenses and try to determine what a range of sentence is for that particular type of offense. We're talking about corrections. We're trying to, first of all, there are a whole number of things that we consider, of course, in trying to determine what an appropriate sentence is. Prison population or capacity ought not be an overriding consideration at this point. It's something that must be considered, obviously, and there needs to be a mechanism to deal with it. But I can't say it any clearer than that.
If the legislature agreed with you, do you believe the judiciary of this state would support some kind of mechanism that would involve accelerated release in the case of overcrowding that would result, if it resulted?
The judiciary would, I think that there's little doubt, but that the judiciary as a whole, the circuit judges at least, that sentence on felons feel, first of all, we need more space. Given limited space capacity, though, I think that the judiciary believes that the legislature ought to take the bull by the horns and determine, first of all, if we don't have space for these people that ought to be in, then to devise some mechanism for simply releasing them early. That's my feeling. Certain classes of offenses, the less serious offenses, the ones, in fact, that the parole board is releasing early now. But there ought to be some legislative direction. I think that that's an important policy decision that ought to be controlled by the legislature. Given that we have these individuals that ought to be incarcerated, we're going to have to turn them loose early. There ought to be more, I think, direction from the legislature as to who those offenders ought to be and under what conditions and how early ought they to be released. My recollection of what Judge Uragwan said, and I'm trying to recall now, I think when he testified in April before this committee on this legislation, was that he felt that the board now had the authority to release people given overcrowded situations. My recollection of his statement was that he would rather that the legislature actually decide who and under what conditions those people ought to be released. But if it became a situation where capacity of the prisons was to a point where they simply could not increase populations anymore, that they were prepared to make that decision as to who was to be released. That's my...
My question was, assume the legislative direction. I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I was just curious, though, if you feel that the judiciary generally would share your view that if we were to essentially leave the consideration of capacity out of the formulation of the matrix or the exercise of any sentencing role by the judges, and if that continued to generate an overcrowding problem, whether the judiciary would... for its part, feel it would be responsible for the legislature to try to provide a release process to alleviate overcrowding.
I've conferred with my comrade here, and Judge Hargreaves, I believe, agrees with what I've said, and that is that if it's clear that the reason the people are being released is that simply there is no space. That judges would agree with that concept. It's not the first choice, obviously. When we send people to state institutions, it's with the idea that they deserve a prison sentence. And when we impose sentences, it's with the idea that they deserve that particular sentence. But there ought to be some mechanism for releasing if, in fact, the population is at a point where there simply is no longer room. Okay.
Great.
Quick reference to page 6, section 7, and that has to do with the limits, we've discussed this previously, I know, within which PSIs must be furnished. And I think reference has previously been made that those, as far as corrections division is concerned, those particular time periods are unrealistic. Those are ideal. Frankly, though, it's my belief that we'll be inundated with requests for delays because in many areas in the state, those PSIs cannot be prepared within that period of time. I don't know what an appropriate period of time should be, and I can't aid you in that regard, but I do believe that the time periods of 20 days when in custody and 30 days without will require the court to act and to extend the period of time in large numbers of cases. Section 8, beginning on page 7, deals with the mandatory minimum sentence that's been referred to previously. And my first question really has to do, I think, with my philosophy, and that is, why is it necessary now that the minimum sentence be within the range that the Board on Prison Terms will devise? We do have a system of checks and balances now. And some may argue with the way that it's working. I know that it does require an affirmative vote of 4 of the 5 members of the parole board to override a minimum sentence, but we do have a system of checks and balances. I can only assume when they choose not to override by a vote of 4-1 that it is a situation where they firmly believe that the person ought to be incarcerated for that period of time. And if in fact, and this is an area again where I feel that prison capacities are creeping into what we may determine to be good corrections policy. We're concerned about the capacities of our institutions, I know. But an overriding consideration ought not be the capacity. There are those individuals who have demonstrated through repeat behavior and particularly aggravated behavior that they ought not be released for a certain mandatory minimum period of time. And if judges are to have the discretion to set those minimum sentences, as I said before, we do now have the authority, or the parole board does now have the authority to override. We have a system of checks and balances, which they can exercise and do in about 30% of the cases, as I understand it. And frankly, I don't think the system is operating all that badly with the mechanism we have now. I have observations again. If the bill is adopted with the provision as it now exists in Section 8, which would limit minimum sentences to the matrix range, I have a question about how aggravations are to be dealt with. Now, as I understand it, the parole board may extend a period of incarceration beyond what now is set forth in the range if they find certain aggravations. Now, would judges have that authority also? Could judges set a minimum sentence beyond what's published as the range for that particular offense if they make certain findings in aggravation? Is that contemplated? I believe that it should be. Additionally, although I don't favor that provision as written, limiting minimum sentences to the matrix range, if it is adopted as it's now set forth in 2087 in the bill, there are, as you know, certain aggravated offenses where, frankly, the range that's devised is just completely unrealistic. And I'm not going to come in with a parade of horribles here today. I have reviewed a number of cases, though, that in our courts involving extremely aggravated situations. People that have been convicted of murder, for instance, in one case, who is on parole for a period of time and then raped and sodomized a woman, slashed her wrist and kicked her out of the car for dead, who miraculously, after losing something like a third of her blood supply, did live. And given the parole board's matrix calculation for this particular offense, came up with 60 to 80 months. This is after he's already been convicted of murder, incarcerated, and while on parole, commits the new offense. And the judge in this particular case imposed the maximum penalty. Actually, the defendant was convicted of attempted murder and kidnapping, imposed a period of 20 years with a 10-year minimum on each charge to be served consecutively, and I don't know that anyone in this room would argue with that, given this individual's history and the seriousness of this offense. 20 years with a 10-year minimum consecutively. The parole board matrix on this, the calculations were 5 to 6.6 years, and judges in these sorts of cases simply feel, and I think it's appropriate, that the matrix range is just completely inadequate to deal with this sort of offense and this sort of offender. And if the judge in this case was bound by the provision that you're contemplating, requiring us to set the minimum sentence within that range, the maximum that a judge could have set would have been 6.6 years on each of these offenses. This particular defendant, this is my own personal opinion again, has demonstrated through repeat violent behavior that he can't be trusted, that the rest of society ought not have to suffer that risk soon. And
Judge, we have created a structure beginning in 77 which was intended to give the judiciary a rather active and hopefully effective role in the actual determination of the matrix itself. Now, if the matrix is as deficient as you indicate in certain situations, my question isn't meant to be snide, a reflection that the commission is not receiving that concern in the formulation or its recommendations vis-a-vis the matrix? Are the judicial concerns not being heard in the formulation of the matrix?
I don't think that's true. I think that, first of all, the commission has had to deal with prison capacities and population, and it's my belief that that concern has crept into the setting of the matrix. I don't think there's any doubt about that, at least as far as I'm concerned. But beyond that, the matrix is meant to deal with average situations, unfortunately, and requires a mechanical application of a numerical formula. You simply cannot equate some of these situations, the one that I've just read to you or referred to some, you cannot mechanically apply a matrix to every situation and come up with an appropriate sentence. In some of these cases, extremely aggravated situations, there needs to be some process whereby a sentence may be imposed which is substantially beyond what the matrix calculations equate to, and that's simply one of them. This is an outrageous case. I don't think anyone would term it as anything other than that. There may be cases of attempted murder where no one would argue with a 5 to 6.6-year sentence. I'm not saying that I would agree necessarily, but there may be. We see cases like that from time to time. But this particular case I've given to you is an aggravated situation. You see, the danger if you pass... Maybe I'm getting to it this way. The danger if you pass this particular type of provision is it takes away the judge's discretion in dealing with the exceptional case. And we assume that you want us to exercise discretion, and I think judges generally do. I do have the statistics here that Bob Watson furnished to you, and I have a copy of it, that shows that I know that judges around the state impose minimum sentences with varying frequencies, but the ranges generally are something in the neighborhood of 25 to 35 to maybe 40% in some of the counties. So something roughly a third of those individuals sentenced to Corrections Division are sentenced with minimum sentences. As a matter of fact, the statewide average is 30.8. And just given my experience on the bench in sentencing defendants, that doesn't seem inappropriate. There are probably a third of those particular cases where defendants, because of such horrendous records or extremely aggravated facts, deserve more than the highest number of months that are calculated under the matrix. And at least we have now, with the system we have, the authority to set a minimum that might be beyond the range, and the safety at the other end is the fact that the parole board, if four out of the five agree, they can override it. So we do have a system now that allows the judge to exercise discretion. But in situations where it's appropriate, the parole board override it. And I think the system we have now for imposing minimums with an override by the parole board in appropriate cases is a good system. It does allow the judge to use discretion in those cases that are extremely aggravated. With the bill as it's drafted now, we would lose that. There's simply little purpose, if this bill passes with Section 8 in it, of a judge setting a minimum sentence. We ordinarily reserve those minimum sentences for cases where we look at the PSI and see what the range is and say that's entirely inappropriate given this case. And so, because of the aggravated nature of the offense or the extremely aggravated history, record of convictions of the defendant, it's just extremely inappropriate, we set a minimum sentence. If we felt that the sentence that was dictated by the matrix was an appropriate sentence, there's no need to set a minimum sentence. If in looking at the history involved and the offense, it's deemed that this is an aggravated situation that deserves a longer period of imprisonment, then we impose a minimum. So if the bill passed, frankly, I think that few judges would impose minimum sentences. Nothing would be gained by it.
Okay, go ahead. Thank you.
Section 10, beginning on the bottom of...